We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 223 for October 6th, 2021. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about the looming enrollment cliff in higher education and some solutions for what we can do about it. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is just Bill in Denmark this time.
Yeah, I'm here. Go off and
nice. Yeah, we were talking before the show, man. Denmark and really that whole area is someplace I've just wanted to visit a lot. And I've been to Finland just for a couple days. It was actually over the summer solstice in 2004 or 2005.
Wow.
And that was amazing. It didn't get really dark at all, and it kind of got dark around 11:30.
Wow.
Basically light again at 2.
Yeah. Holy cow.
So, but yeah, that whole area.
This,
yeah.
I was going to say, this is a little bit further south than that. So the sun is going down at, you know, 7 or 8 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Plus it's September.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, when we can truly travel again and my work situation changes, so I'm not like beholden to clients all the time. Man, we've got like 225,000 airline miles and I've got credits from canceled flights still. And it's like, we're going wherever we want for free.
That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I fully endorse Denmark. I'm right now in Aarhus, which is not the main, you know, it's not the Rick Steves Europe travel that we're so used to, you know, when you see that whole Europe. I mean, I think he spends like probably 12 seconds outside of Copenhagen. So the thing that you see on all the postcards and everything, that's Copenhagen. So I think I made it there for like, I've only been here a couple of weeks, but basically getting off the airplane and waiting for a train was my entire Copenhagen experience. But I'm going to go back there and I'm going to go there for some research at the University of Copenhagen and maybe at the National Museum. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be in a week or so, early October. Okay. And so, yeah, then I'll have time to actually check it out and compare the difference, because Aarhus is like a regular town. I don't know if there's a boatload of tourism here, but I definitely don't think it's oriented the same way as Copenhagen. And so when you're around here, it's just families doing all the stuff that families do. It's a university town. So, you know, a lot of students, a whole bunch of stuff oriented towards that, which means it's young and it's doing its whole thing, but it's just an everyday town. Right. So, you know, it's not the picturesque postcard place that you would think. But one thing that's pretty interesting, though, the archaeology department at the University of Aarhus is in a palace.
Nice.
I'm not joking. Someone donated a palace that their archaeology and their heritage studies departments are there. So whenever you go to check things out there for archaeology, or, you know, in my case, to go and talk with the other scholars that are sponsoring me here, we just go to, you know, like this, I don't know, 18th century palace. It's also got this massive garden. I guess they have a Jurassic garden where they tried to recreate what the landscape was like in the past. I haven't figured it out. Yeah. It's a pretty amazing place.
Crazy. Yeah. Well, maybe at some point in the future, when you got a better handle on the situation there, because you're going to be there for a while, we should have a special episode talking about the cultural, like the CRM situation in Denmark. Yeah. You know, do they, how do things, I'm curious at how things work there and how much you learn while you're there. Because I know, like in the UK, like the crown owns everything under the ground, for example, when stuff is dug up, and there's a lot of regulation there. But I'm always curious as to how other companies treat their other countries treat their cultural resources, especially when, you know, something that's a few hundred years old, you know, we go nuts for historical resources over here when they're, yeah, when they're 100 years old, but 100 years old over there is just like trash in your backyard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure they don't spend any time. Most people's houses are probably 100 years old over here. So I don't really think that they spend any time with that stuff because, you know, I went to, it looks like it's pronounced the Mosgaard Museum, but they don't say it that way. And my mm-hmm. Danish pronunciation is a horror story. So they've got amazing collections there. I mean, it's a totally extraordinary anthropology and archaeology museum that if you go to Denmark, it is worth the, I think, 3 hours or whatever train ride away from Copenhagen mm-hmm. to go check this place out because it's extraordinary. Once again, like I said, it's on a palace on their estate, right? So there's that whole aspect. But you know, when you're there, it's crazy because they're, you know, they've got some traces of Neanderthal. I guess Denmark mm-hmm. was still under glaciers for most of that, or it's been scoured away. So their closest stuff is like the very edge near Germany, their border with Germany. They've found a couple of artifacts and stuff from there. But yeah, like that's kind of where the story begins, you know, like 100 and something thousand years ago, 50,000 years ago, they start talking mm-hmm. about, you know, their stuff. And then they've got a lot of Bronze Age and, you know, Neolithic stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. You're looking at stuff that's like 11,000 years old. I mean, I don't know how many tons of it they have, but in every display case, those artifacts are coming yeah. from multiple sites in Denmark. So it's not the same. And also, you know, they care a lot about their, you know, heritage resources and archaeological sites. So, you know, I was asking someone about CRM, you know, I noticed that they built a lot of freeways and mm-hmm. I was asking them, so, you know, did you all find a lot of sites when they were doing that? And they were saying, yeah, you know, we got past the whole, like, let's survey and look and see if something's there. And now we just go and like find all the sites and dig them all up. And I was shaking my head mm-hmm. like, whoa, they don't even like test them or survey for them. They're like, no, if there's anything in the way of this, we just do the archaeology on it. We don't hesitate. I was shaking my head like, huh, maybe I should tell the Department of Transportation back home, like, hey, so anyway, I went to this place and every time they see a site, they don't waste any time on evaluating. They just do the archaeology on it. Like, you should check it out. Their museums are amazing because of that.
Nice. All right. Well, like I said, I would love to come back to that. That would be pretty cool. Sure. Just to learn a little bit more about what they're doing over there. But let's get into the topic at hand today. So you dropped a few links in our Slack chat for this podcast. And mm-hmm. Obviously, you're a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And so you're very deeply involved and concerned with enrollment numbers in anthropology programs. And as a mm-hmm. as an aside, you know, the anthropology program, I'm pretty sure, was shuttered at my university where I got my undergrad. And mm-hmm. and the few students that were remaining were kind of rolled into like the history department. But I'm pretty sure they shut the department down officially with still have anthropology professors, but it's not like it was when I was there. And then we talked about on several different episodes of podcasts on the Archaeology Podcast Network, the shutting down of the archaeology department at the University of Sheffield mm-hmm. in the UK, in Scotland. Scotland. So it's happening right now. And we've got a few articles. Check the show notes. We've got a few things that we'll put in here. But one of the top ones that I hit is really something I hadn't thought about, is talking about declining enrollment numbers for the next 10 years or so. Well, 5 years or so mm-hmm. related partially to at least the declining birth rate in the US. So there's just fewer people that are going to be going to college, let alone, you know, other reasons why they might be shuttering these departments. So
yeah,
let's get into this topic.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, just to kind of set the stage for it, I think by now, after the whatever, I don't even know what zillionth month of COVID, if you ever hear anyone say something like unprecedented, that's not mm-hmm. what they mean. What they mean is something that's normal that I have not seen before. That now is just like commonplace, right? So things like pandemics, things like attempted coups on the United States government, like things like people just denying that they have a disease as they die from the disease, those things are now just normal. Mm-hmm. And so moving into this whole universe of these normals that we haven't seen before, it's been a long time since the United States birth rate was declining like it is now, and especially with the pandemic, right? So I'm not really a demographer, but looking at the articles that I've read about this, they're saying that our birth rate is down like around the place where it was around the Great Depression. So almost 100 wow. years ago, where people were just not having kids, right? And if mm-hmm. you look at that time period, you can see some correlations, right? Like a huge gap between people who had money and people who didn't have money, and economic depression that was harder for people to, you know, make ends meet, Dust Bowl, right? So a huge swaths mm-hmm. of our country were made, the fertility collapsed and people had to sell their farms. So like people were not having kids because they didn't know what was going to happen next. And that sounds, you know, quite familiar to what's going on today. But
sure.
the thing that I shared is coming from an organization called Coupa HR, which is the human resources professional organization for university human resources departments, right? So we always think about, you know, the admin as these amorphous monsters that are just sucking down, you know, money from the university. But actually, the human resources department is one of the things that makes the university actually work by having people to fill all these positions that do all the things that keep a university open. And so they're keen on enrollments and stuff, right? Like if there's not students who are going to college, there's no money mm-hmm. for anyone to be at a university, which means there's no human resources, which means that, you know, people aren't getting hired. And like we were saying, departments are going away. And so yeah. one of the things that they've come up with is that there's just a decline in the total number of college-aged people in the United States. And so they're kind of trying to forecast out. Of course, the report that I shared was made before the pandemic, but they're trying to forecast ahead, you know, what do they see is going to end up happening, right? Mm-hmm. And so you know, one of the things that I believe that they've come to, and I'll have to look back at the report, but one of the conclusions that I believe they came to is that places like the University of California are going to be doing all right because they're in large states with a lot of people and, yeah. you know, there's a lot of students who are going to want to go there. Now, the smaller schools, the private schools, not Stanford, but the small schools, right? They're the ones who are going to suffer greatly because it's difficult for them to justify people paying that much money to go to those universities. And then the private ones, you know, it's all up to their endowments, right? So they need enrollments. They need their endowments to do okay. And if they're not getting enrollments because everybody wants to go to UCLA or Stanford or Berkeley, then, you know, they're going to be in trouble. But extrapolating that outside of California, there's massive sections of the country where, you know, there's a potential for, you know, there to be fewer college age students. The state doesn't have a reputation for quality education institutions. And before, when there were so many people, Gen X and, you know, millennials now, they overbuilt their programs. And so they were preparing for more and more enrollments. But now mm-hmm. we're going into a phase where there's just fewer people. And so those schools are going to be in trouble. We're starting to look and see some of these smaller private schools are getting shuttered in the United States. But the other thing that matters a lot for archaeologists is they're cutting departments like anthropology, right? Because right. those departments a lot of times have smaller enrollments. And I also shared another file that comes from the American Anthropological Association that talks about up until, I mean, I think the survey data ends around like 2010 or 2011, but they were showing that anthropology departments were showing decreases in the number of undergraduates across the United States. And I can't remember how that report concluded. I mainly looked at the demographic information, but you know, all of these signs will be sending something to, you know, folks who run CRM companies, because of course, in the United States, mm-hmm. young graduate archaeology students are the kind of bread and butter. Like they're the ones who are the future of cultural resources. And so yeah. right now we're seeing, you know, a lot of jobs are open in CRM, but we might actually end up in a situation where there's more demand for cultural resources than there are young people to actually fill those jobs.
It sounds like a pretty tough situation. And going back to California, talking about the difference between the private schools and the state schools too, the private schools are going to have even more of a challenge going forward because, mm-hmm. well, in California and in a lot of states, if you're a resident of that state, you usually get a break on your tuition going to a state school versus a private school, if I'm not mistaken, like versus mm-hmm. somebody coming yeah. in from out of state to go there. You typically will get a break on it. So that's going to be more of an advantage for the state schools as you know, affording this education and justifying it gets more and more difficult.
Well, I mean, it's a blessing and a curse though, right? Because, you know, if you are a state school and you're getting state funding and, you know, the state's solvent, which we still don't even know which states are going to be bankrupt in a little while.
Yeah, right.
If you're running a program, you know, yeah, you want students from that state, but you want to be so prestigious that students from out of state will want to come. including ones who, you know, don't necessarily meet the criteria for residency. So they're going to pay that out of state rate. Now, I know that like these really selective schools like Cal and, you know, USC and stuff like that, there's going to be way more people who are going to apply than they can accept. And so like even in a time when there's fewer humans, those schools are so prestigious, people are going to apply to them. But I remember going to the University of Arizona, and, you know, from what I heard about Arizona State, they were advertising heavily in California because they wanted California students to come and pay out-of-state tuition, which, you know, that was less than a lot of the other schools in California. So they were always trying to recruit people from California, and especially Arizona State, which is like, the last time I looked, they said that they had 79,000 students enrolled. Jeez. And they were trying to get as many people online, and they were trying to turn every single course into an online course. Like everything had to transform so that they could get as much tuition as possible. Because at least when I lived in Arizona, we had an ice cream salesman as the governor who didn't want to put any money into the schools. And so they were all suffering. And I think that guy is still the governor. So those schools, their budgets are getting slashed and destroyed. And ASU's system was just to try and get any human that can fill out a FAFSA to enroll in school. And so, you know, that if you're a university that's relying on these out-of-state students and there's just fewer people no matter where, then yeah, they might stay in state and go to a place, you know, that's going to give them that tuition waiver or that benefit. And, you know, if there's fewer people in that state, then they're actually going to qualify because the bar will be lowered from people that have like a 4.5 GPA down to just people who have like a 3.8 or a normal GPA like I did.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty crazy to think about that whole thing, you know, as individuals. Most of the folks who are listening to the podcast, they either went to college or are going to college. And so, you know, it's not very long since they've been applying to these schools and watched them get turned down and watch them be like, ooh, you know, you're a prime candidate, but what I seriously want is someone to come from out of state to take that spot. Well, they might not be as choosy for your kids coming up in the future. And all that selectivity might come back to bite them in the end.
Right. All right. Well, let's take a break. I've got some ideas and some questions about, you know, the trend these days of people to just not go to college and how anthropology and archaeology could pivot and accommodate that if it's even possible. So let's talk about that on the other side of the break. Back in a minute.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code CRMARC. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to episode 223 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. And we are talking about higher education and the enrollment problem that is existing and getting worse and going to be worse in the future for various reasons. But let's talk about that. Let's embrace it, right? Like if there's almost nothing that we can do about it, there has been a growing trend, I would say, in the last 10 years, probably more, but really in the last 5 to 10 years, especially in probably the tech sector, where people are saying, don't go to college. I've got a friend who has built an entire career out of writing books and telling people about not going to college. Like, you don't need it in order to make a living. Now, in some cases, that might be true. If you want to be an app developer or you want to get anywhere in the tech space, like, it's almost better if you don't have a degree, because they're almost like Palo Alto and Silicon Valley is almost shunning degrees at this point, because why waste 4 years going to college when you probably spent your formative years in childhood playing video games and learning how to code? And they could just hire you as an 18-year-old fresh out of high school to start writing code for Apple. I mean, seriously. Sure.
But the only thing I'd throw in there is it's your insurance policy, right? Because those same corporations yeah. cut labor and collapse and go under and go right. through mergers like tons. And so what are you going to be like, you know, a 60-year-old person that never went to college that played a bunch of video games 40 years ago? Like, that's not really going to cut it. So it's always an insurance policy. And if you can afford it and you got the time, then, you know, college seems like it's the ticket for our full generation. I don't know if we fully have transitioned yet.
Yeah, but if you're that 60-year-old person that played video games as a kid and you were coding and you took 2% of every company you worked for until you were 40, then maybe you don't need to work right now.
Maybe, yeah, exactly. Or the meaning of work is different when you're 60 anyhow, I think. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So let's talk about alternatives for this is a CRM archaeology podcast. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about our alternatives for professional archaeology. I would say mostly in the United States, because that's where most of our audience is. So do you think that there is an avenue? It probably doesn't exist yet. Now, there are some, like, I went through a 1-year graduate program, but there's no like short undergrad programs. An undergraduate degree is still required in most cases. Now, in a lot of cases, they'll hire you with experience. California does that all the time. They'll hire you with experience. Even if, you know, you've been doing CRM for 30 years and you never got a degree. There's a lot of people like that, right? So I think as those people are transitioning out of the field, that's becoming less of a thing, especially as more engineering firms start buying up the smaller firms. Mm-hmm. They are still requiring a bachelor's degree in anthropology, archaeology related field. So let's talk about when that becomes less of a requirement because fewer people actually hold those degrees. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, is it possible for someone to gain the necessary skills and abilities needed to become a field archaeologist at the entry level without going to college? The programs probably don't exist yet, but what would they look like?
Yeah, I mean, it hypothetically, yes, those of you who have done CRM know that you could easily learn how to do CRM if a company just hired you and then you spent 4 years doing it full time. Like, everybody knows that that's a possibility. There's a couple of things, like, you know, I used to be one of the ones, of course, a privileged person that has a college degree that was like, well, you know, that was mostly hogwash and I didn't actually use all that stuff. And, you know, I kind of wasted all my time, right? I think I wrote a blog post about it too. And there's a bunch of professors that will find that I never learned a single thing that I ever used in your class, that I spent hundreds of dollars back when college was hundreds of dollars on those degrees. And I never used any of that stuff. And it was all just a trick to get me to go to school for even longer, because I could have focused for 2 years with a field school on archaeology and finished when I was like, you know, 19 years old and gone on to do CRM. But that's not really a thing. And, you know, I think that, so yes, in a perfect world, we could have people know how to do cultural resources without going to college. The only problem is the people who hire those folks are looking for someone who has a college degree. And then the other thing is the overall economy in the United States is looking for people who have a college degree. So, you know, we talked about this before on the podcast. You know, the shelf life of archaeology career is not long. It's not, it's definitely not 50 years, right? Like, you might find professors that have been around for 50 years doing work. You might find them that have been doing for 30, or principal investigators at CRM companies that have been doing it for 30 years. But most of us last like 10, maximum 20 years before we move on and do another career, right? And so if you don't have that degree, What are you going to switch to? Like, look at the jobs in our society that hire people. Like, you will have to become an entrepreneur if you want to make it with no degree after 20 years of doing cultural resources. So, you know, like I said, like, that's the kind of insurance policy, because our economy is biased towards people who have college degrees. And then, like, of course, the elephant in the room in cultural resources is the Secretary of Interior Standards.
Yeah.
And like, you know, that's why a lot of master's programs pretty much exist in anthropology, so that folks who have done CRM for a little while can go and get a master's, and then they can, I mean, I myself went on to get a master's so that I could stay in cultural resources.
Right.
So like, that's a major motivator. And as long as that's a requirement by the government, now there's some talk about kind of changing that or having some exceptions to that. And like the key piece would be having Native American people who are working on their own heritage sites so that they don't mm-hmm. have to do 6 years of college in a, you know, a state university outside the reservation or whatever, have them be considered a professional of their own cultural knowledge. There's some movement on that, but everybody's so afraid to change the law, like the National Historic Preservation Act, rather than thinking about that we could get something better. I mean, Tom King has been talking about this for a while. Everybody's so afraid that if we get rid of that law, then we'll have nothing and then everything will fall apart, that we're just mm-hmm. clinging on to all of it, including the Secretary of Interior standards.
Yeah.
So I don't know if in our lifetime we'll ever get to the point where, you know, what we consider avocational or people who don't have a college degree are doing cultural resources. As long as the Secretary of Interior standards calls for a master's, the people who are running the projects in the United States, they're going to have a graduate degree.
That is true. Something I was thinking about while you were talking about that is, especially given your position at Berkeley, a major institution in its own right, let alone just for anthropology. What is there any talk, and, you know, I know we don't want to talk about things that are, you know, behind closed doors there, but is there any talk about, I guess, pivoting just a little bit with the teaching strategies? And what I'm thinking about is I'm thinking back to my own education, my own undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. You know, let's leave the graduate degree aside. Those are a little bit different, but my own undergraduate degree, I mean, it basically was just like, you know, kind of like watching 4 years of the History Channel. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was like, let's learn about these civilizations and these societies, but yeah. Almost none of that is transferable to anything. Like, it's good and it's fun to know. And that's why those of mm-hmm. us that are interested in history go into these professions, because we like learning about that history. But is there any thought to adding more technically minded skills at the undergraduate mm-hmm. level, not just at the graduate level, not just like writing and stuff like that, but I guess more stuff that could be actionable outside of anthropology yeah. to entice people to come in and say, hey, you're going to pay a lot of money for this degree because you're at a fancy school, or even if you're not, you're still going to pay, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. If it doesn't pan out, you at least have these skills.
Yeah.
Because right yeah. now, what the hell good is an anthropology degree in most cases? You know, there's a lot you can do with it. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of people that will hire somebody who has studied, you know, human culture and stuff like that outside yeah. of archaeology and anthropology. But that being said, people might not be able to see that at 18 years old when they're saying, well, yeah, what if this doesn't pan out 2 years after I get my degree? Then what do I have? I have a mountain of debt and nothing I can do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, okay. So, did you watch the show The Chair on Netflix?
No, haven't seen it.
All right. It's about a woman who becomes the chair of a small English department at a liberal arts college. And I totally recommend you watch it, because it gives me PTSD tremors over the reality of my own experience of being a professor. And I'm not tenured yet. So on the air, I will say nothing about my own experiences as a professor, but go watch sure. The Chair. I'll tell you, just go watch The Chair, because what's going on The Chair, you can imagine, is happening at your own alma mater anthropology department, because studying esoteric English literature is very similar to studying esoteric archaeological cultures that were made up by someone, you know, in some other random place, right? And so if you watch that show and you pay attention to what's going on, that is the actual, it's a simulated, take away the, you know, what's going on with the, you know, the lead character. I don't want to spill all the beans, right? But take away the whole sexual tension thing, take away the whole what's going on in people's private households, what's going on at the actual workplace. It's doing a pretty good job of, you know, giving you a glimpse as to what's happening. And so in a nutshell, you've got an entire generation of tenured professors that have been there anywhere from, you know, the last 6 years to the last 60 mm-hmm. years as professors at these different departments, who have built their entire career on writing a bunch of books and giving a bunch of lectures and digging a bunch of archaeological sites and becoming the expert in one corner of the universe, right? And they're well received and acknowledged by all the other peers and everything, right? That never did a single minute of cultural resources.
Yeah.
And the only time they've ever talked to anyone who's done cultural resources for, I would say, at least 50% of the archaeology professors in the United States is when they were at a conference and one of their unfortunate, in quotation marks, colleagues had to work in, you know, private industry, right? And so that's the reality that many people are facing, right? Like, you're going to these universities, the people who are teaching you have never done CRM. I'd like to say it's changing, but I'm also watching the people who are applying to professor positions at my school and at other you know, places. And I don't see a lot of CRMers applying to become professors. I don't mm-hmm. see a lot of people who have done cultural resources applying to go on for a PhD. So, you know, I don't see where there's a pipeline in the next 20 years or whatever of people who know about cultural resources who are going to come and take these, you know, occasional tenure track positions. Right. So I end up being one of the only people who's ever, you know, had to hustle for cash doing archaeology that's a professor at my my institution. You know, there's not very many people in my department that have ever done CRM. And if they did, it was like a summer or two while they were PhD students to just, you know, tide them over till they wrote their dissertation. So most of the people who are teaching and running anthropology departments, they like the only experience they have with CRM is from anecdote or from occasional projects where they partnered with, you know, the local county or whatever to do a small project. Right. So like, I don't see where we're going to have people who know what young people need to learn in order to have transferable skills. Now, I spend a lot of time, we live in Silicon Valley, right? So I spend a lot of time trying to get those basic skills. You know, technical writing is applicable in every single field.
Right.
Trying to get students to, now it's crazy. Before the pandemic, they had to collaborate and do group projects, which they totally hated. And then they had to do it mostly online. And then the pandemic happened, and I just maintained that same series where people have to work together on these projects and they have to put it all together across the, you know, entire semester, which simulates what you actually in fact have to do in CRM, which is you're never the number one person doing everything. You have to work with other people and you have to work together to get the project done by the time that it's due. Well, you know, students always complain that they don't just get to go home and, you know, type a generic term paper into a machine. They have to actually work together. But that's what you got to do in the workplace. So I try to do as much of that kind of stuff in my classes, but my classes are not like the other classes that I've ever seen taken at a university.
Yeah. I mean, just thinking about university classes, I feel like anthropology departments are, you know, 10, 15 years behind all the time,
if that,
you know, current trends. Yeah. If not more,
if that, they could be, you know, 40 years behind if depending on who the people are who are running it. Like I said, if you've got a bunch of, you know, senior scholars, full professors that are in their 60s that never one time, you know, did CRM, for them to not just be openly harassing people and racist is considered like, you know, like they've totally changed. They're basically borderline MLK in their mind because they're just not like openly screaming racial slurs at people. But which, you know, the SHA last year, guys are using, you know, Nazi hand gestures and just banding them around like they're nothing. Right. That kind of age of person. If that person is running these departments, like, you know, that look at the mountain that they'd have to climb. They're just barely learning how to be a civilized 21st century person and recognizing that maybe they should have done more than just only study one tiny archaeological horizon in one site in one part of the world. So, you know, that, like, I just see that there's a big hill to climb, and it's really going to be the students, unfortunately, that have to make the change happen. And they just have to basically do it by doing the kind of projects that are going to help them move forward. They're going to have to talk to other people in CRM and try to figure out the skills and things that, you know, companies are looking for, and then just use the assignments in class as kind of like the test study for those things, right? Like, you know, they're going to have to actually do all the legwork because, you know, if you're a student and you're listening, do not expect your university to somehow overnight realize that 90% of its graduates go into CRM. And that 99% of their graduates don't stay in CRM for more than 20 years. Like, your department's not going to want to hear that, and they're not going to actually be thinking that way. So it's kind of up to you. If you want to do archaeology, you're going to have to, you know, don't be like me at least, and just do your assignments, march through, get your degree, and then be sitting there pushing shopping carts there trying to figure out how to get a job. Like, you know, you're going to have to listen to the podcast is a good first step, but calling companies nearby and seeing what kind of person they're hiring, what kind of skills do you need? I mean, that's really your only hope. Don't expect your university. They're going to give you the degree. It's a diploma. It's evidence that you were there, right? That you're not, that you have above average intelligence and that you know how to follow instructions and get something done for 4 years. That's what the degree is showing you. So, like, you know, the undergrad degree, just it's who you are. You're going to have to network. You're going to have to connect and learn those skills on your own. Don't expect your professors to help you.
Okay. Well, on the note of don't expect your professors to help you, let's take
especially not me.
Break.
Don't email me. You know what I'm saying? Do not email me. I cannot help you all. No, I'll help you. If you email me, I will try to help you the best I can.
All right. Let's take a break and we'll come back and wrap this up back in a second. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. All right, welcome back to the final segment of the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 223, talking about declining higher education enrollment, but actually I feel like we're pivoting a little bit into, well, what can universities do? Yeah. What are the alternatives here? And it seems to me like there's a shift happening in how people who work at universities, such as yourself, are starting to realize exactly what their situation is. Because school administrators, university administrators, they've always known that a university is, even a state-run university, is a business. Like, if you're not concerned with money coming in, money going out, you're going to fail, right? Yeah. Like, this is a business. But people in the departments, the professors, I feel like the shift is finally starting to happen where they're realizing that as well, because the days of the, you know, the 80s and back and even further back than that, where you get this cushy professor job, you're wearing your tweed jacket, you're smoking your pipe and you're walking to school, you know, that kind of stuff where you've got that like endless job security, money's flowing in and you don't have to worry about enrollment. You just teach and do research. Those days are gone, right? Like those days are absolutely gone. So it seems to me like the head of the department, whatever department you're even talking about, in this case, anthropology, if not archaeology, the head of the department really needs to be like a PI in a CRM firm. Yeah. They need to be somebody who has business skills. And that's another problem entirely, right? Like PIs and CRM firms also don't have business skills. Like they need to get those. but to run a proper department, you need to think of it like an engineering firm runs a department, right? Like they have people who are doing business development. They have people doing all that stuff. And really universities kind of need to do the same thing to stay alive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you would assume that that's the thing. And, you know, so far we've spent half an hour, 40 minutes bagging on the situation. But all I want to tell folks that there is total promise in this future of fewer universities. And the other, there's a couple glimmers that I'm seeing. First of all, I am seeing, it's kind of sad, but I'm seeing how students don't want to go to college and they're kind of pushing the issue. So they're not just following the line that they must get a college education and move on. Now, the problem with that whole thing is it's students of color and poor students. And I don't understand why or how, but men also are not enrolling. For example, I saw a statistic that said that this 2021-22 year, it's 60% women who are enrolled as freshmen at universities, right? So that's going to be a problem in the future for many different reasons, right? But the big thing to take away from that, as far as like the discussion that we're having right now for archaeology, is without students just automatically marching off to college like robots, like they have, you know, since our generation, right? It's forcing universities to think. And also in these kind of situations, when it comes to anthropology departments, it's forcing some departments to think things that they've never actually thought before. For example, collaborating with CRM companies. Now, that's one thing that I'm starting to see happen. Like CRM companies, because they can't find students, are starting to have these different internships and stuff like that. And then for the last year, as we're advocating to diversify archaeology, we're starting to have these indigenous, BIPOC, different kinds of underrepresented groups. They're trying to have these internships and connections with students that have been overlooked by CRM. And, you know, I'm just starting to see like a couple of them pop up here. But the thing is, companies are starting to connect with universities to try and get those students to just do the teaching piece before they graduate, right? Because if you can get in there and you know, have a student spend a few months, you know, sorting out state site records or, you know, writing up site cards or maybe even going out to the field or, you know, working in the lab as like a paid internship, first of all, that person's getting professional experience before they get their degree. And the company is actually training up their next round of employees. In Arizona, that's just like the way things are. Like they find people at Pima Community College. They, the field schools have CRM folks who are working on them at the University of Arizona. So they're already screening and teaching the students like from the time they're undergrad. Well, I'm starting to see that thing kind of happen in the Bay Area too. So, you know, that's the glimmer of hope is that students now have a chance. They don't have to just wait until they get their degree. They can actually do CRM as a paid intern, as a person who's working with a company, you know, before they finish. And in that thing, like now it's not just about finding a way for you to, you know, fill up cups of coffee at Adobe. Like I take that back. I don't know if they actually have their interns do that kind of stuff. Right. But in the, in the Bay Area, getting these, the line to sign up for these tech internships is like, you know, you've got genius level people that'll do anything to just say that they worked for Google for the summer or something like that. Well, it's not like that for CRM yet. However, I don't, because Google and those other ones are so, you know, prestigious, I don't think that they really have to spend the time cultivating their next round of employees because they can take the pick of the litter. But with CRM companies, it's totally advantageous for you to train up your next round of people before they graduate from school. And so if that's not going on where you live and you're listening to this, I mean, definitely reach out to some of the CRM companies. You can find them on LinkedIn. Send them an email, tell them about the podcast, about, you know, these things. If you're in the Bay Area, like I can try to aim you towards the companies who are actively looking for folks. Like they're realizing that they can't wait for people to finish school because they need employees now. And so they're just trying to build those employees before they finish the degree with the understanding that they'll finish the degree and then they'll be a full-fledged field tech that already has like 2 months of experience under their belt.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like, as far as the universities themselves, like, I mean, many are going many different ways, but one of the things for folks that are coming up now that are young, it seems like it's never been easier for you to go to college. you know, all the rejections that we faced, you know, you're like, no, you're not good enough. Well, those things might kind of be waived in the future since they're just looking for people to go to university. So in that regard, if you are in high school or something like that, or you have a way to get, you know, community college credits or credits at your school or something like that, just grind those basic credits out, like do them online, get them, get college credit as soon as possible. That lessens the amount of years you have to spend in college, but it also like kind of catapults you past the, you know, the stuff that I had to take right when I first got there, like intro to theater, which is like, I mean, I watch movies, dude. I don't know about theater. The only time I ever go to the theater is when my in-laws are in a musical. Like that's the only time I ever go to, and I know almost nothing about Greek tragedies and I got an A in the class. So blow past those things if you can when you're a high school student so that you can get to the actual archaeology and the stuff that you want to do.
In the last half of this segment here and finishing out the podcast, let's talk about some really wacky alternatives to education in the future, right? Because one thing I was thinking about every time I think about these big engineering firms and you were kind of alluding to this with, you know, them training up their next workforce. Why don't we take that a step farther and say, man, if some of these big firms would do like, say, like the military does, right? The military will basically pay for your college education. You have to become an officer and stay an officer for like 4 years or something like that, whatever the commitment is to actually cover your education. If it's something they can use, you know, a degree they can use, then they'll cover that. What about taking that a step further and looking at these big engineering firms like Wood and, you know, AMEC and those types that have literally billions of dollars that could really just use their internal resources probably to start because they have a lot of PhDs at these organizations, right? But use these internal resources. Now, this would require basically firms not requiring an official university degree, but more of a certificate level degree, because a degree, an undergraduate degree, of course, includes your gen ed classes, your stuff that's not anthropology related, right? Whereas a certificate, most certificate programs would be just the things you need in that field, right? That would cover that, and maybe whatever courses help support that. But what do you think about a big firm like that just having their own in-house certificate program where you actually go there, you study for a year, or maybe it's probably online, mm-hmm. to be honest, but you study for a year, 2 years, whatever it takes to get the certificate in a full like university type environment, but completely run by the company. And then at competitive salaries, you're under contract to work there for the next, like, you know, however long they decide, 3 or 4 years or whatever it is. And then you can go off and do your own thing, because they wouldn't want to educate you and then have you go work for somebody else. But
yeah. Well, I mean, that's going to end up happening eventually anyhow. That's going to happen anyway. Like, they can't stop us.
No, but they require you for a short period of time, and then it's up to them to keep you based on incentives and benefits and salaries, right? So you could probably buy out your contract if you won the lottery and you said, hey, here's $30,000. I want to go work for somebody else. But, you know, in the end, that would be it. You would come out of it with a certificate, with the ability and experience to work, but not having paid for any of it, right? Like, they're covering the whole bill.
Here's an alternative that is so doable that I'm surprised people aren't already doing it. But, you know, if I ever pay off all my student loans, then I will do it myself. Like, what is it? The little red hen? Like, who will help me do this plan? Not I said the anyone, not I said the Chris. Very well, I will do it myself. And I will enjoy the bread when it's baked, right? So, all right. We've got places like California and Washington State and New York where people make way the hell more money than people who live in places like rural Indiana and upstate New York and, like, you know, the mid-America, right? All right. So what if there was a university scholar that was either, heritage studies or history or geography, anthropology, like any of them, right? What if this individual started a program where for one semester you had to take this class called historic preservation funding or something like that, or funding historic preservation, where in the class you went through like three alternative properties that needed to be repaired. And they were in like inland, you know, heartland cities or something like that, Illinois, Indiana. Like, you know, you would spend time looking at what's an actual candidate that you could make money. Because, of course, this program only benefits if you actually purchase a property that needs some repairs, then have the students in the next class, which could be a summer class called Documenting the Built Environment, Documenting Historical Structures, Documenting Archaeological Sites. You make sure that you find a site that's older than 50 years old, preferably around 100 years old. You do all the GPR in the backyard to you know, identify any archaeological deposits. You know, I guess if you wanted to do some kind of excavations, but once again, you're like kind of digging and finding artifacts that you don't plan on like curating. So that's kind of, you know, inappropriate or whatever. But, you know, you could do all the 3D mapping, all the scanning, all the before the after photos. And then students who, if the building doesn't need like too much repair, like if you're talking about fixing on fences or, you know, painting or doing some other stuff, students can work on that thing, or they can actually watch the process of the architect designing the remodel on the house and then, you know, working and budgeting and watching the developers fix on the house. And then when the house is fully finished, it can either get like a stamp of historic preservation that's through the student arranged historic preservation program or something like that. And then it can be rented out as an Airbnb, or it can be sold so you can buy the next property, right? So in that class, there would be like a fall or a spring component where you spend all the time looking at historic preservation regulations, trying to figure out if you can get the tax benefits, looking at these three different properties, analyzing the, you know, purchase and all the other different stuff, but also just learning about the National Historic Preservation Act and the local historic preservation laws for that location. And then, you know, you can build it out from there where people learn about the ethics of preservation and, you know, a whole bunch of different stuff. And then the summer class would be a 6-week program of doing the architecture drawings, doing the subsurface evaluation, building all kinds of digital models, overlaying maps, making story maps, interviewing people that live nearby about this location in the neighborhood and all that stuff, and possibly, without, you know, hurting students, possibly doing some landscaping or some other kind of remodeling. But meanwhile, they watch the developer work on the house and fix the house up. And then that thing goes into either the university's portfolio as a property that it owns, or it goes to the scholar's portfolio, or it goes to the CRM company's portfolio as a thing that it can sell later on. And you just keep moving through different properties. So it's a 2-semester investment for students. It fulfills the obligations of a field school, even though it's like an architectural history field mm-hmm. school. Of course, you'd build it out to do even more over 6 weeks. You know, I know you'd have to do more than just, you know, have them do the drawings or whatever, but you'd be looking at materials, you'd be looking at historic preservation, guidance, technical guidance and stuff like that. And at the end of it, the student knows about historic preservation law and how it's applied and the ethics of historic preservation in the United States. They also know about, you know, a little bit about architectural history, a little bit about, you know, architecture, materials, landscapes, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So they can go into an architecture program, or they could go into a historic preservation or an anthro or a historical archaeology program if they wanted to later on. Or they can also just finish their program, you know, like it is. And in the meantime, especially if you had like a CRM company involved in some way, they're basically showing their skills and in making a portfolio to show for potential clients, right? So if a company did it, all they really need is a university to sign off on the credits for the two classes. So they need an instructor that's accredited at the university to teach that those two classes so that the students can get, you know, the experience. And then the company gets the asset, or the company gets the experience, or the company basically becomes like a small-time real estate, you know, manager. And they can also build that out further for their own business. Because like one of the biggest things about CRM companies when people go to sell them is they don't have any assets because the company doesn't own anything right. but reports in old contracts that could, you know, easily be assumed by another company.
Yeah.
So like the true value in a CRM company is its people, its connections, and its experience and its ability to do work. But those things don't have very big value on the market. Well, if you had 32 mm-hmm. properties scattered across, you know, different parts of Ohio and Indiana and shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then all of a sudden you have multiple millions of dollars of real estate and land. And like, you know, even if they wanted to go even further and start buying like old farms and stuff and documenting all the artifacts in there and 3D modeling the whole landscape mm-hmm. and all that stuff, like there's places where you can get a full fledged farm for like the amount that you can get a one bedroom apartment in San Francisco. And so those are the kind of things that like, Any department could possibly do this. Any company could do this. Anybody could end up doing this kind of thing. This is that out of the box thinking that like, you know, this whole industry needs that stuff, but nobody's really doing that yet.
I mean, isn't that how McDonald's ultimately ended up making billions? Is they became a property management company and, you know, they franchise out, but they own the land. Somebody else owns the restaurant, but they own the land. And,
yeah,
you know. I mean,
yeah. You're well, totally yeah. Right.
Why
I mean,
not build a portfolio like that.
Yeah, I don't know, man. There's all these websites that I'm like, you know, I surf them and I drool all over them, right? Because I'm in my middle ages, and I guess mm-hmm. at that point in the Monopoly game, you want to start getting monopolies and shit. But you know, I look at all these places as I'm living in California, and you know, houses on my street are pushing $1 million up from 600 and something thousand, right? So I wouldn't be able to live in my neighborhood if I had moved there now, just 2 years later. But I look at all these places where there's just all these sweet, you know, 100-year-old houses that you know someone's going to get a deal on it, and they're going to go in there like property brothers, and they're going to blow it out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all that, all those elements and all those materials and stuff, all that stuff's just going to get ripped and thrown, and they're not going to rehabilitate it because it costs more money to rehabilitate an old historical building, right? Well, what if there was someone out there who refurbished older homes and, you know, kept them alive and then brought them back to like whatever code is necessary in that area and then sold mm-hmm. it out, right? Like, you know, I don't know how the whole thing would work. You have to do a lot of market research to try and figure out the markets where you can rent it out for a functional price. And then, mm-hmm. you know, you need the startup, the remodeling money, right? Sometimes you buy a place for like $60,000, but it needs $100,000 in work. So with the students and with other people, indeed. You evaluate these deals, right? And then you buy them and then you fix them up and then you move on.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, that is definitely an interesting model. And I think we've covered a lot of, you know, started with a problem and ended up with, you know, a number of potential solutions. Because if you're not constantly thinking about your pivot and how you're going to stay relevant and how you're going to keep providing value, whether you're in university or a CRM firm, then you're destined for, you know, failure. So,
yeah,
it's an interesting time for sure. Yep. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Bill. Thanks for this topic, and we'll see everybody next week.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Take it easy.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.